Sorry. Oh, there we go. Okay, there we go. We're good. It's all good now. You can hear me. It's Easter. And so I wanted to welcome you, especially if you're new with us. Thank you so much for being here with us today. You are our honored guest, and we don't take that lightly. There could have been so many things you could have done on an Easter morning, but you spent it with us. And so I want to thank you so much for being here if you're new. But hey, for the rest of us, glad to see you again. Glad you're here as well. And it's a great day to be new, though, because we're going to start a new series today in Colossians. So if you want to turn to Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 through 23 is where we're going to be. You can look that up on your device, turn to your Bible. We'll have it up on the screens for you as well if you need it. But man, here at Redemption Church, we want to see people go from restless to redemption. And one of the ways that that's going to happen in our lives is when we learn to make Jesus above all. And if you're like me, when we start thinking about putting something above everything else in our lives, the ways that comes to mind is usually the ways that I don't do that with the right things, and I do it with all the wrong things, you know? So it's usually the opposite. I want to put something that's most important above all, and then I end up putting something that's really kind of dumb above all that doesn't matter at all. And so I had a great example of this. My wife's parents got us a Wii a few Christmases ago. Great for the kids, of course. Okay, the Wii's for the kids. I do tend to play on the Wii from time to time, just every once in a while, here and there. And so we got Mario Kart to play for the kids, right? And I made it my life's mission to beat the Mario Kart game. So that's what happened with the Wii. I ended up playing it, and you know, they're all always like, hey, can we play? I'm like, no. It's daddy's turn to play, okay? And so I played, you know, nights, weekends, just chipping away, trying to unlock each character and unlock each course and all of the things that are there. And I almost had everything unlocked after a few months of doing this, only to sit down one day and turn the game on, and there was nothing there. It had been deleted, okay? It was a tragedy of epic proportions, and come to find out, after interrogating very intensely all three of my children, it was my four-year-old Beau. He had gotten on there, and he had deleted all of my progress up to that point, by mistake, I think. It wasn't maliciously, okay? But I was very upset, and you can imagine what ensued. I don't think that I overreacted. I really don't. I didn't yell at anybody. He still has his life. You know, there were no bruises or anything like that, okay? Wasn't like that. But he cannot be on the Wii by himself anymore. That's just the rule now. He cannot get on the Wii unless somebody is there watching him. And you'll be happy to know that once I started playing again and after another few months, you'll be happy to know I made all of my progress back, and I just want to say in public now, I have beaten the game, okay? You hold your applause. It's okay. It's all right. And the reason that I share that with you is because it doesn't matter at all, right? I mean, honestly, who cares that I beat Mario Kart Wii, except for me, maybe. It's not important at all, and of course, I'm trying to be silly about it, but I do think that we all tend to do this with things in our life, don't we? We put things above other things that shouldn't be there. We'll make something above all else that really has no business being there at all, even good things maybe, like our career or our definition of success or gaining financial stability or even our family or our kids. Yeah, something like that that's very important, but we put it above all else. I don't know what it is for you, but that thing, whatever it is, cannot compare to what should occupy that place of primary importance in our lives. And the Bible is going to show us today what that actually is, and that's Jesus that needs to be above all in our life, right? So this is going to be a main point for today. If you're taking notes and you want to write this down, if you're a note taker, Jesus is above all. That's what we're talking about today. That's the whole point here of what we're going to read in Colossians chapter 1. And to really believe that Jesus is above all, we're going to need a revolution of the soul. And maybe you've heard of the Copernican Revolution in 1543 for you history buffs and geeks that like this kind of stuff. Nicholas Copernicus is famous for finding out that the solar system isn't geocentric, which meant that, you know, everything revolves around the Earth. But he's famous for finding out that it was heliocentric, meaning everything revolves around the sun. And what was obvious, or what's obvious to us now, was like revolutionary to them then. Nobody understood that, and it wouldn't be until Galileo would come along in 1610, and Kepler and Sir Isaac Newton, some names you probably have heard before, and they proved unequivocally that the Copernican theory of heliocentricity was true. And at that point, finally, humankind would finally stop seeing ourselves as the center of the universe and realize that we revolve around something much greater and much larger that gives the earth life and light. And I think that this is a perfect illustration for us of what it looks like for us to finally start following Jesus. That's what it looks like for those of us who've put our faith in Jesus. We have our own Copernican revolution of the soul because we realize that life isn't what revolves around us. It doesn't revolve around what we want in our lives. It changes everything that we think and believe and do. It changes life as we know it. I mean, the Copernican revolution changed science, scientific inquiry as we know it. Fundamental reality change for us. But that's what meeting Jesus does in a different kind of way. It's not about me or you anymore. It's not even about humanity as a whole. Life is about God and what he has done for us in space and time through Jesus of Nazareth. All the other things that we make much of, they just kind of start to fade away. They become less important. They pale in comparison to that thing which gives us life and light and is so much greater than we could ever imagine. So let me just say, if you're not a Christian and you're here today, you wouldn't say you follow Jesus. Man, I'm super thankful that you're here. Easter is one of those times that we might want to seek out these things. And what I want to try to do today is just help you keep an open mind. That's what I want to ask you to do, is just keep an open mind here and don't just dismiss these claims as though they're just silly. This is what Christians have believed for the last two millennia. All across the world, all across history, and right now, over 2.3 billion people are Christians across this world. I know that's not a proof for the Christian faith, but it should at least maybe keep you from dismissing it without having seriously wrestled with and considered the truth claims that Paul's going to make here in 1 Corinthians. Because my hope for you today is that you're going to have a Copernican revolution of the soul. But if you are a Christian and you're here, maybe you even grew up in church, but you wouldn't necessarily say Jesus is at the center of your life right now. And your life revolves around other things in life, maybe your job or your hobbies or maybe your kid's sporting schedule. I don't know what it is for you. Whatever it is, it doesn't revolve around Jesus. I want to challenge you today. You also need a Copernican-like revolution, because if you're letting all those other things, as good as they might be in your life, crowd out Jesus above all, man, then you're not really following him, and you're probably not really a Christian, because it's one thing to believe that he is the savior of the world. It's a wholly fundamentally different thing to actually lay your life down and put your faith in him and follow him for the rest of your life, such that your life revolves around him. He's not just one of a few things that revolve around you. So let's just go ahead and get into the text together, because it's going to teach us what that means for us today here in Colossians chapter 1. We're going to start in verse 15, and this is what Paul wrote. He said, he, speaking of Jesus, of course, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation, for everything was created by him in heaven and on earth, the visible and the invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him, and he's before all things, and by him all things hold together. Whew, man, that is a lot about Jesus right there. And before we look at the rest of this, just to give you some context, what's going on here is the Apostle Paul is writing from jail somewhere. Most people think from Rome, could have been somewhere else, but they probably thought it was Rome. And he was writing to the Colossian Christians, whom he'd never actually met. He didn't know these Colossian Christians, but he had heard about them, and he was encouraged by them. And so he was writing to encourage them in their faith, to continue maturing and continue growing and growing closer to Jesus. But then here he shares this poem with them, which is really interesting, because in verses 1 through 14, he encourages them, talks about how he's praying for them, which we haven't read today, but he starts here this poem that either he wrote or that, you know, he got from another source, and it's about what Jesus has done in the world and who Jesus is to the one who says they've put their faith in him. So as you can see from what we just read here, that is very, very big. And he's actually connecting Jesus to Genesis chapter 1. Because the claim is that Jesus is the creator God. This is how another apostle, John, put it when he was writing his gospel. He said, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. All things were created through him, and apart from him, not one thing was created that's been created. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. That's the argument Paul's making here as well. That's the argument that Christians make. Human history revolves around Jesus. He's the life and the light of men. He's the word of God incarnate. He's the image of the invisible God. So if you're taking notes and you want to write this down as well, you can write down everything is made by, through, and for Jesus because Jesus is God. Everything is made by, through, and for Jesus because Jesus is God. You and I, we were created by, through, and for Jesus. Like I wasn't created for my job as a pastor. I wasn't created even for my family, as good as they are. They weren't created for me. None of us were created to be followed by people on social media. None of us were created to have power and control in our lives at all costs. None of us were created to do whatever we wanted to do. We were created by, through, and for Jesus. We weren't created for anything but for him. He's above all. That's the argument here. And that's what firstborn means. When we look at verse 15, it's not saying that Jesus is the first created being. That's what some people will take it as. He wasn't the firstborn in creation. He was the firstborn over creation. Paul's referencing Psalm 89, which says, I will also make him my firstborn, greatest of the kings of the earth. It's a psalm about the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah that would come in the future. And he would have the position of ultimate authority as the firstborn over all things, the kings of the earth, all power. And Paul is saying Jesus is that Messiah. He's the firstborn here. See, firstborn meant the first of first importance. That's how we'll say it, of first importance. The first in position, the first in power, the first in authority. Because see, in Israel, the firstborn would gain the inheritance of the father and the position of the father after the father had died. And so Paul is saying that Jesus is equal to the Father here because he is the firstborn over all things. He is the creator God. He has that power and position and authority that only God has. And I know that's one of the biggest problems that most people have with Christianity. You know, Muslims, Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, a lot of other people teach that Jesus was just a great man, maybe even a great teacher, but they react strongly, some even violently, when you start saying that Jesus is God. And I think that it's because there's something inherently threatening to our sense of self if Jesus is divine. Because if he's not divine, and he's just a good moral teacher, or he's a wise guy that can help us help ourselves, we can still define who we are. We can still define how we want to live our lives. But if he's God, you see, and he's actually really above all else, then he gets to define who we are and tell us how to live our lives. We can't use him, he uses us. We can't control him, he controls us, right? He's the firstborn in position and power and authority. It's all for him, by him, through him, all of that. It's all for him. And then there's this interesting language here in verse 16 that I also want to point out. Everything is made by, through, and for him, things both seen and unseen, things that are visible and invisible. And what Paul is saying is that even in the spiritual realm, which, you know, is mysterious, we don't fully understand it, we can't really know it, he's above even that. The things that we can't understand, the things that are in our life that we can't see. And so it's important to realize, for example, let me just give you one example, that Jesus is above the evil that we see in this world. Like that doesn't mean that he causes evil or wants evil to occur, but it means that he's over it because he's over it all. He's overcome the evil that we see in the world. Because listen to the rest of this. This is what it says about that. Verse 18, he's also the head of the body, the church. He's the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he might come to have first place or be preeminent in everything. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him and through him to reconcile everything to himself, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Once you were alienated and hostile in your minds as expressed in your evil actions, but now he's reconciled you by his physical body through his death to present you holy, faultless, and blameless before him. If indeed you remain grounded and steadfast in the faith and are not shifted away from the hope of the gospel that you heard. The gospel has been proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and I, Paul, have become a servant of it. Man, this is really cool stuff because see, what it's saying is Jesus has overcome all of those spiritual things, including the evil that we see in the world by reconciling us to God through his death and resurrection. So you can write it down like this and then I'll explain it afterward, but you can write it like this. Jesus is God's answer to evil. That Jesus is the answer. When we bring up questions about evil, Jesus is the answer. Paul introduces the problem here and tells us we're evil. That's what he's saying. He says in verse 21 that we've chosen alienation. You know what alienation means? It means separation from God. When we treat other people with contempt, or we lie, or we cheat, or we steal, when we're selfish and self-serving, when we're prideful, even when we're anxious, man, when we do anything that goes against God's good design, that's evil. That's what it distances us from God. And it's caused the brokenness that we see in the world. And death is the result of that. Which kind of makes sense if you think about it philosophically. Just think about that. If our Creator is the source of all life, if he's the one that sustains life, gives life now and both into eternity, he holds it all together, it said here. If he really is that and we distance ourselves from him, what does that mean? What's that naturally gonna lead us to? It's gonna lead us to death. If we distance ourselves from the source of life, then it's gonna lead us to death. But God's answer was Jesus. We're running from God, but he ran to us by coming into the world to save us, right? Jesus came into the world, verse 20, to reconcile all things to himself. All things, everything, whether in our seen world or whether in the unseen world, visible, invisible, doesn't matter, whether it's in nature or society, whether it's in our own hearts or the hearts of others, it doesn't really matter because he's overcome it all. And he's above it all, and he's reconciled it all, which means he's made the broken relationship that we have with God whole once again. And he did that, Paul says, by raising from the dead. And that's what we celebrate at Easter, is it not? That's why we're here. We're here to celebrate this raising from the dead. And he used the word firstborn again in verse 18. I don't know if you saw that or not. He said, firstborn from the dead. What this means is Jesus has the position and the power over death because he raised himself to eternal life. He's the resurrection and the life. And he raised from the dead, and it enables him to be the first in everything, that firstborn with power and position. Him raising from the dead enables him to be that, but it also proves that. It proves that he's God. And it guarantees our relationship with him so that it's all about what he's done for us, not about what we've done for ourselves. And I think this is the crux of the issue here as well when we kind of enter into this kind of conversation, especially at Easter. If Jesus didn't raise from the dead, then of course he isn't God. Of course not. It's of no real importance if he didn't raise from the dead, right? But if he did, man, that should change everything. About life as we know it, it should change everything for us. It should be revolutionary. As author and theologian C.S. Lewis once wrote, Christianity, if false, is of no importance. If true, it's of infinite importance. The one thing it cannot be is of moderate importance because we're dealing with eternity, death and life here. If it's true, it changes everything. It has to. We're talking about God dealing with all of the evil, destroying death on our behalf so that there will be no more death. It's big stuff. But I know some still might ask the question, yeah, but why did he allow evil in the first place? Why did he allow us the choice? Why did all of this kind of stuff? Why didn't he get rid of evil in the world now? It must either be because he's not loving or he's not powerful enough. What's the deal with this? But see, this passage right here should shatter all of those things. It has to, because he defeated evil on the cross by dying at the hands of evil men. And he did that to reconcile all things to God. He's dealing with the evil. Now, it might not be the way you want it to be, but it's the way God has made it for us. And it's not just gonna deal with the evil now, but it's gonna deal with it into eternity. So he is above all, even evil. Because if he didn't raise from the dead, then what we believe is false. It's crazy. It's what we read right before during our worship time. It's not worth following. Why do it? Don't even waste your time. Just do whatever you want. But if it's true, then consider what that really means for you. It revolutionizes how we fundamentally look at and believe our lives should go, right? And if you're here and you're skeptical about that, you're skeptical about Jesus raising from the dead. I don't have time to go into a full-blown, you know, defense of the resurrection, although we could. I mean, there's quite a few books have been written on this subject. And when I say quite a few, I mean thousands of books have been written on this subject. I do quickly want to say two things, though, just to help jumpstart that in your mind. I would encourage you to consider, one, the historical evidence of it. Like, is there enough historical evidence to validate the claims made by Jesus' followers after his death and then what they claim to be his resurrection. Of course, I think there is. Obviously, that's one of the reasons why I personally believe. That's one of the things that actually brought me back to the faith when I was in college. I did a lot of digging with another guy that's actually sitting over here right now who was in college with me. And we dug into this. Does this make sense? Is there historically verifiable claims? I think that there is. So I would just encourage you to go after that. You can come talk to me after the service if you need some resources on it. I can point you in plenty of directions there for that. But then the second thing I think you have to look at, and maybe even the more powerful thing here, are the eyewitness stories that we see for the last 2,000 years of people who claim that they've encountered this risen Jesus. Now, I'll start with Paul because he's one of the best and most famous here. Have you ever heard Paul's story, the guy who's writing to the Colossians here? Well, he was known in Jewish circles as a Pharisee. He was a Pharisee. That means he was an expert in the Old Testament law. He had to memorize large portions of the Old Testament. So he knew the Old Testament inside and out as a Jewish leader of religious law there. And he started to hate the Christians. See, he was a young man. And he started hating with zeal all of the Christians that he saw because he did not believe that Jesus was God or that he'd risen from the dead. Just go read Acts chapter 8. Drug some off to jail and saw others stoned. He was all about that. But then on his way to Damascus one day to yet again persecute even more Christians, the risen Jesus appeared to him, he claims. If you go back and read his story in Acts chapter 8. And he appeared to him and all the people that were traveling with him. He was blinded and he spoke to the risen Jesus and it completely changed everything for him. He had that Copernican revolution of the soul. His life went from revolving around the law and his identity as a religious leader to revolving around Jesus. He went from persecuting Christians to living on mission as a Christian. It was a radical transformation. He went from being a persecutor of the church to being a leader of the church. He went from hating Jesus and thinking he was a false prophet to following Jesus as the true prophet, priest, and king. I mean, it's just a radical transformation. So when you have those kinds of real world accounts of complete life change. I mean, even looking at the disciples themselves, Peter and all the other guys, radical life change. They were so afraid after Jesus died that they went to an upper room and they were scared and hiding because they thought Rome was going to come in and get them and crucify them as well. Wouldn't you think that if your leader was that way? But just a few short weeks later, after they've seen Jesus risen, something changed about them. They go from this scared, hiding group of people to a group that would go out and change the known world at the time. All over the place, in the face of persecution, in the face of jail, in the face of death. What is it that changes people like that? What gives them that Copernican revolution of the soul? What gives us that? I mean, my own personal story is the same thing. Maybe I'll tell it to you in detail sometime. But I really wanted to live the American dream. I didn't want to live for Jesus. I had the furthest thing from my thoughts, okay? I promise you that. I did not want to do that in my life. And yet, there was some nagging feeling for me, that there was more. There was something there, and I started delving into all these different things. I mean, I could not come back to the historical evidence of Jesus and his resurrection. I could not come back to that. And finally, when I decided to put my faith in him, it was like a light switch, man. It was just a Copernican revelation. I can't explain it any other way. It was just total life change. Everything else changed in my life. That's how it's been for 2,000 years for every Christian up to this very moment. What do you do with those kinds of testimonies? I'm just saying for you, if you're a skeptic, I'm just saying it would not be wise for you to just dismiss that. Ask yourself, why would this particular claim of the resurrection, if false, go on to turn the entire known world upside down from that point on and shape the Western world as we know it? But also, why are there so many stories of people's lives being radically changed and transformed? And just considering those two things, I think, at least the history and the personal stories, you've got to at least wonder, is it true? You've got to at least wrestle with that, I would hope. So I hope you'll take pause and do that today. I hope you'll talk to somebody that you either came with or somebody who's a Christian that you meet here today and just wrestle with that. But I also hope that it starts to make you want it to be true. When you start to hear people's stories of life change and what's happened in their lives, because what Jesus has done for us is supremely beautiful. If you look on the face, just listen to this again from the passage. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him and through him to reconcile everything to himself, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Man, nobody saw that coming. once you were alienated and hostile in your minds as expressed in your evil actions, but now he's reconciled you by his physical body through death to present you holy, faultless, and blameless before him. Man, that's a kind of beauty that I don't think you should dismiss. You can write it down like this if you're taking notes. What Jesus has done for humanity is supremely beautiful. This is such a beautiful story. The God, creator God of all things, comes into the world to save those who've rejected him and alienated themselves from him. It's a total story of forgiveness. And we ought to want that to be true. I mean, you can see the brokenness in the world, I would think. You can see all the problems that we're having just in America, not to mention all of the other places in the world. As a species, we cannot deal with those broken things appropriately. We just can't. I mean, we try time and time again, and when we try, it's almost like we mess it up even worse. Even in our own lives, we'll come up with principles that we ourselves want to live by, and we can't live by them. We're just not consistent enough. We're emotional. We're crazy. Whatever it is, I don't know what it is for you. We can't even do that for ourselves. But what's so beautiful is that God has dealt with that for you through Jesus. Just think about what Paul's saying here. There's a personal God that you've alienated yourself from. He could have destroyed us. We don't want Jesus to be above all. We want to be above all ourselves. But instead of destroying us, he loved us. He overcame evil with love. He's not that caricature God that you always hear about as vengeful or spiteful or lacking in grace and forgiveness. He's the God of grace and forgiveness. That's what he's all about. Because he sent Jesus to reconcile all things, including you and me. That means we can be in a relationship with our creator God now. Our good father, our helper, our friend. Because of what Jesus has done. That's the message that we proclaim at Easter. And that's a message I think that's worth at least considering seriously. Because it taps into the deepest longings that we have in our heart. To be fully known and fully loved. And to live for eternity in that way. Fully known and fully loved forever. I mean, in his biography, a guy named Steve Jobs, that I think you may have heard of, he said this when he was talking to the author, Walter Isaacson, who recorded this just before Jobs died. He asked Jobs whether or not he believed in God, and Jobs just said through his life he had seasons where he did and seasons where he didn't. But he found that as he was facing the prospect of his own death imminently, he believed in God more and more. And when Isaacson asked him why, he said, because I just can't accept that the body just turns off one day and then it's all over. You're gone forever. And then one day, the sun of our solar system just goes out. And that's the end of human history, just like that. There's got to be more to it than that. We can't just be an illusion of consciousness arising from a fortuitous cosmic accident. Incidentally, he said that that's why he never liked to put on-off switches on Apple products, because he didn't like the idea of just being able to flip a switch and turn something off like that. My point in sharing that, though, is that he knew there had to be more. He knew it. He could feel it. He longed for it to be true. He knew there had to be more than just living this life and then dying one day and it all be over. He longed to be known and loved forever. And even if you don't believe that, man, the message about Jesus is something I think you should want to be true, because it meets those deepest longings of your heart. Another apt C.S. Lewis quote fits here that I think is very appropriate. If I find in myself desires which nothing in this world can satisfy, the only logical explanation is that I was made for another world. Good old C.S. Lewis with some good reasoning and logic right there. So the question that I want to ask you today, as we kind of begin to wind our time down together here, is does Jesus occupy that kind of place in your heart? Does Jesus occupy the place of primary importance for you? Is it really Jesus above all in your life? Because listen, he is above all. That's what Paul is claiming. That's what all of Christianity, that's what all of the Bible is claiming. He is God. He really is above all. He's above everything, and he's dealt with it all. But my question to you is he above all for you personally in your life today? Is he above all? I mean, it's tough. You think about it, it's tough because so many of us want it to be Jesus plus something else. We want it to be Jesus and something in our lives. We want it to be Jesus and success. As long as we can have success, we'll throw Jesus in there. As long as we can have a spouse and kids, then and Jesus is in there, it's great, right? So we want it to be Jesus in success, Jesus in a spouse, Jesus in kids, Jesus in personal happiness, as we define it, of course, not as somebody else would or as he would, but as we define it, Jesus and religion. Jesus and doing all the right things or believing all the right things or making sure we say all the right things. It's got to be Jesus plus something. We think will give us everything that we want. And our hearts drift in that direction. We're alienating ourselves from God. So it's tough in that because that's the natural bent that we have. But it's really not complicated. It's just not. The Bible is telling us we need this Copernican revolution here. It's got to be all or nothing with Jesus. It has to become the center of our lives and nothing less. It's got to be Jesus plus nothing equals everything for us. It's Jesus plus nothing. It's all Jesus. That's what it has to be for us. As soon as we try to add something into that equation, we've made it equal to or greater than God. We need this Copernican revolution of the soul. Because how can we know the one above all if we try to put anything else above all in our lives? How can we know the supreme ruler of the universe if there's something else ruling supreme in our heart? You see how that works? It's all or nothing with Jesus because he deserves it all. He deserves all praise and honor and glory. He created it all. He spoke it all into existence. He holds it all together. It's all for him. And when you don't put Jesus above all, what does that leave for you and Jesus? He deserves it all. And you're not giving him what he deserves. Just think of it like this. Just think of it like this. Imagine you went with a friend to their doctor's appointment, okay? And they had a disease or an illness. It was very serious, it's gonna take their life within a few months. But imagine when you go to the doctor with them, the doctor says, hey, good news, there's a cure for this. But you will have to stop eating some certain foods, you'll have to stop drinking some certain drinks so that it won't interfere with the treatment that you have. You ready to start? Well, let's get you scheduled. Wouldn't it be silly if your friend looked back at the doctor and said, wow, I'm really glad there's a cure, but I won't be able to eat whatever I want? I won't be able to drink whatever I want? Man, forget that. You know what? Let's not worry about it. I'll just go home and not deal with this. Can you imagine how silly that would be, right? I mean, it would be absurd to not give up some things in view of something so much more valuable to you, so much greater. But that's what we do with God all the time. That's exactly what we do with God, with everything in our lives. We do the same thing. We might long for the Christian message to be true. We might even say that we believe that it's true, but we're like, yeah, but I can't have sex until I'm married. Yeah, really? Yeah, but I can't just do whatever I want, whenever I want, with whoever I want. Man, I can't still maintain control. I can't still define beauty the way that I want to define it. I can't still do this. I can't still do that. Listen, if that is the way that we're looking at Jesus, then we missed it. We've missed the beauty of it. We're saying we want to do it on our own and be above all. And Jesus is saying, listen, you got to see me. You got to put me above all. If you do that, you place something that's of less importance, whatever it is, above God, who is of infinite importance. Because listen, if there's a God who really is the source of life, he really is the source of truth, he really is the source of beauty, and he wants to live with you for all ages, starting right now when you put your faith in Jesus, and you get to live that out forever with him and have all your deepest longings met. But there's this one little thing over here that you still want to hold on to and you don't want to let go of. In light of that, then you don't get that. You don't understand the beauty. And it's okay to know that that's where you're at. But you missed it because you haven't understood the depth of what he's done for you. You haven't understood the supreme, surpassing beauty of what the gospel message really is. But Jesus told a parable like this about it. He said, there was a man who found a treasure buried in a field, a treasure of immeasurable value. Totally, just think Count of Monte Cristo big, right? Okay, if you ever read that book. Immeasurable value. So he could get everything he ever wanted. So what he did was he left and he sold everything that he currently owned so that he could purchase the field and have the immeasurable valued treasure that was within it. Jesus says that's exactly what the kingdom of heaven is like. It's like a treasure buried in a field that's of immeasurable value. You give up everything else that you have to gain something so much greater in return. That's what you're doing. And that's what it looks like to live with Jesus. He is worth having. It cannot be Jesus plus something else. It's Jesus plus nothing equals everything that's worth having. And if you still need help telling whether or not that's how you live your life, let me show you three things that I think will show you what's above all in your life right now. These three things, very simple, and we'll be done. Time, talents, and treasure. What do you do with your time? What do you do with your talents? What do you do with your treasure? This will show you what you really believe is above all in your life. How do you spend your time? Are you selfish with it? Are you always doing things for yourself? Or do you maybe spare a little time for God here and there, right? Are you sparing time to spend with other believers? Are you sparing time? Are you prioritizing time with God in the mornings? 10 to 15 minutes of your day to go to scripture and to go to him in prayer, to meet with the God of the universe who has reconciled you to be able to do that. Is that how you're spending your time? Because if you can't give up a little time to meet with the God of the universe, then you've missed it. You've missed it. But also, how have you lived out your talents? Have you been gifted in something that you keep for yourself? Do you use your talents to maintain control or to try to gain the approval of others or something like that? Or do you use your talents to serve Jesus and the kingdom of God, even if it's in your job, right? To glorify him. Do your talents glorify yourself or do they glorify God? But then finally, how do we spend our money? Because what does the Bible say about how we spend our money? Where our money is there our heart will be also, right? So where we put our money is where we put our heart. And that could look like giving a certain way. I don't know, I'm not talking about giving here. I'm just talking about what do you think of your money? Do you believe that your money has been given to you by God to use for his purposes in the world? Or do you think that it's yours and you can just do with it whatever you want to make yourself happy? See, time, talent, and treasure will always tell us what we believe is above all. But there's also one more thing that will do that in our lives, and that's our joy. Or maybe our lack thereof. Maybe you don't have any joy in your life. Maybe you're even a Christian. You've been in church all your life, but you have no joy. Why not? I think, friend, you've missed it if that's the case. I think if you can't have joy and know that this eternal perspective is true of you, that God has done this in your life personally, then you've missed it. Because what it does is it gives us a different kind of perspective. We've had a revolution. We've had a revolution here. Everything has changed. Our lives no longer revolve around us or things that we think are gonna make us happy. We don't get caught up in trying to be happy in certain ways, and when we don't get it, we get down. No, no, no. We've been given everything that we need for joy and satisfaction for all eternity, and that eternal perspective is what gives us joy. That's why Christians are so weird, man. That's why Christians are so weird. That's why we sing and we raise our hands and we're excited about it. It's because we believe what Jesus has done for us. We believe that. And it gives us joy. Such joy that, man, we should want everybody in the world to know it. And that's why we share it with people. And so when you have that kind of joy, it will give other people a glimpse of the supreme, surpassing beauty of what Jesus has done for you. When you share that love that he's had for you, when you take people along that journey that you yourself have been on, and you sit down and you consider and you debate and you talk, maybe even argue a little bit, hopefully in good faith and in good, you know, conscience, and you're not being ugly, but you go back and forth, you talk about these things in a loving way, and you show them what you found. You take them to the buried treasure that you yourself have found, and you share it with them. So I want to introduce a story here as we close out our time. A guy named Michael here at Redemption Church, and this is what happened to him. And what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna introduce the video, we're gonna watch it, and then I'm gonna come back up and I'm gonna lead us in our time of response here. All right, let's watch the video now.
I met Michael right when we moved to Roanoke. I met him when I started the Y. I started working there. He'd already been working there for a few years.
The first time I met Matt, he just opened up about his church and the church plant that he was in and his love for Jesus, and it seemed real. And he was talking about the people at his church, and it just seemed very authentic. I could see him just lighting up when he got to talk about Redemption Church and about the work Jesus has done in his life. So my wife and I, you know, we're Christians, and we fell in love with Redemption Church, but life happened and bought a house and had a baby, and it was very stressful, and we just began walking away. Carter actually texted me one day to check in, see how things were going. And I knew at that point that I needed to come back to Redemption, but my heart still wasn't there at the right time. So one day I asked Matt if he could pray for my heart, and that just opened up a dialogue between him and I about our struggles and about our sins and about how loving Jesus is, even despite our struggles and our sins. And over the course of a couple of months of him praying for me and us praying together and repenting together and just loving one another, I came to church Easter of 2022 and was just blown away. And the Lord thankfully just snatched me up.
He was broken, and he was telling me about that, and he was kind of sharing that, and there was a lot of negativity that he had, and I knew that with that brokenness, that was an opportunity for the gospel just to come in and just mess with him, and I couldn't help but just be able to enter into that because I knew what God had did in me. I knew where he had begun to break me of some of my old habits and my ways. When we first come here, I've asked God to let me meet another person who was like me. Let me meet a Matt, the Matt that was in Greensboro, I want right here in Roanoke. And I thought that prayer was gonna be years down the road. And it was like, as soon as we stepped foot in here, I came across Michael.
You know, I know the Lord's using that for me to do the same with other people. And because of that, my wife and I are serving at Redemption. My wife serves in nursery. I serve in hospitality. And it's a chance for us to meet people and share Jesus with them, because that's what it's all about. People are the mission.
We met in our brokenness. And instead of, I think a lot of times we think we have to have it all together. And I think that we lead out in our weakness, just as the scriptures call us to be real with people and look for that. And I think that was just, that it was, I can't take any glory for anything. And Michael could second that he can't take any glory. It just like the Lord was already moving here and we just jumped into that stream together.